For the last 8 weeks, or last 8 Sundays that I've given a message, we've been following the book of James, and we actually finished that last Sunday. And I wasn't exactly sure what the heck I was going to do today, and right until the last minute I was thinking about it. But I got a phone call yesterday afternoon that changed everything for me and changed the direction of what I've been doing ever since. And I heard myself hearing the voice on the other end telling me that our Liz Lippert had died. And I don't know how many of you are aware, but it was either yesterday or late Friday, early Friday, I guess. And they found out, of course, on yesterday morning. And every time I hear this kind of news, we've had 4 really heartrending deaths in the last couple of years here at The Effect. We lost Vanessa, we lost Matthew, we lost Henry, and now Liz. And Liz is one of our regulars. For those of you who don't know her, there are pictures in the handouts that you have. But she is someone who has just been this dear woman who was always willing to do anything. And for the last year or so, she was the donut lady. So she was the most popular person on Sunday mornings. And her husband, Leo, gave me permission to talk to you and to give you this announcement. There's not many details known yet. We really don't know what has happened, at least not as of yesterday. And the details are sort of less important right now than just recognizing that we have a loss. Recognizing that there was this wonderful spirit in this woman that is no longer with us. And you know, we're a recovery community and a recovery ministry, and there's no secret why most of us are here. And Liz had an accident and had chronic severe back pain for years and years and years. And she struggled with those pain medications. Where was the line as to what she needed to take because she absolutely had to, and what was abuse, and she was just over, and she struggled with that. And that was one of her crosses to bear. But through it all, she was just this wonderful spirit, I guess is the best way I can put it. I'm remembering all of our email strings. She could get back to me within 5 or 10 minutes, it seemed like, every time. She was just amazing that way. And connecting and always willing to do something, sitting at our registration table at the last 2 fundraisers, and just always in the thick of things. And it's got this unreal quality to me that I just can't believe I'm not going to see her showing up with a box of donuts next Sunday. It just hasn't got that quality. Leo just felt, he said he was kind of numb. He knew he had a lot of decisions to make, and he was going to put some of them off and just kind of process. So those of you who know Leo and know his family, reach out to them. Let them know that they are supported. And we'll just continue to get you information as it comes up and find ways that we can support the family. But he knows he's loved. He's got some support around him. And right now he's doing okay. But as these things happen, they kick in later. You know, there's those stages to grief. And the first one is denial. It just doesn't seem real. But the things slowly progress. And so he'll need more help as time goes on, especially after things kind of blow over and return back to what passes for normal in our lives. That's when it really kicks in often. So as I was thinking about Liz and thinking about this and the shock of it all, of course my thoughts turned to death and to the afterlife and to all of these things that we, in our culture, sort of tiptoe around. Have you ever noticed how we tiptoe around death? We use euphemisms for it. We say we passed on, or what are some of the other things that we say about dying? Departed, dearly departed, and these things. But we seem to refrain from just hitting the nail on the head and dealing with death, and there's a lot of reasons for that. You know, there is so much fear associated with death, so much unknown associated with death, that we sometimes have a hard time just going through it and dealing with it in a cohesive way. One of the things that struck me that we just talked about last Sunday was when James was talking about, you know, you all say, we're going to go to such and such a town, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do that. And he says, how do you know that tomorrow is going to bring what you think it's going to bring? You know, sort of an arrogant position to assume. And we talked about the fact that control and continuity is an illusion. What control do we really have? The continuity that we see because we think we see, because things have gone a certain way for a certain time, can change in an instant as they changed for Leo and for Liz. We don't know if these things are really going to continue the way that they are. And so there's a certain amount of acceptance that has to take place, which is also a theme of James, accepting life on its own terms, accepting death on its own terms, and finding the connection between the two. Whenever somebody I know dies, the first thing that I think about is, what are they doing now? You ever think about that? What are they doing now? I remember all the conversations that Liz and I had, you know, questions about faith, about life, about theology, or any of the things that we talked about. And all those things we talked about, she knows now. What is she doing? What does she know now? What is she experiencing? What is it like? All the rest of us here are still looking through the glass darkly, but now she's face to face. That's an amazing thing to contemplate. Is she soaring over galaxies right now? What is she doing? What are the mechanics of this next life? We don't know. We have no way of knowing. But Liz does. And that's an amazing thing to me. Celebrate that. Yeah, now we see through the glass darkly, then face to face. You know, I can't wait to see what's on the other side myself. Don't want to hurry it along or anything, but it's going to be an amazing thing. How could it be otherwise with the God that we serve, with the God that Jesus has told us? He is one with that Father. How could it possibly be otherwise? It's going to be an amazing thing. At the end of the movie, the last of the trilogy of Lord of the Rings, there's a scene where all of the life forms, the elves and oaths, who time is up in Middle Earth, are getting on a ship that's taking them, as Tolkien says, into the West, that represents what we would call the afterlife. And as they're leaving, one character, Galadriel, looks back toward the camera and she gives this impish little smile, and she bounds into the ship. Made her look like a child running downstairs to the Christmas tree on Christmas morning. Like, what does this hold? What is this next adventure? What is this next life? And she moves that way into it. That's what I imagine it to be like. An unopened gift under the tree, waiting for us to be opened at some point. But we fear it. We don't know what it holds. In that same movie earlier on, there's a scene of two characters who are going into what seems to be an impossible battle. And one says to the other, I never knew it was going to end this way. And Gandalf, the wizard, who had been to the other side and came back, says, end? No, death is not the end. Death is just another pass, one that we all must take. He said, the gray rain sky pulls back and all is turned to silver glass. And then you see it. And he says, see what? White shores and beyond, a far green country under a swift sunrise. Well, that's not so bad. No, it isn't, he says. I love that rendition. I love that sense of hope, that sense of excitement. This is the excitement that Jesus has built in us when he shows us who the Father is. Who is this that we are going toward on the other side of this line that we call death? How does that work? The journey is not over at death. The journey continues. In what way? We're going to have to wait to see. But at the same time as I'm painting this, we can't paint death all in one color. It's very complex with us, especially for those who are the survivors. And to try to paint it all in one color is to trivialize the sorrow and the grief and the agony that the people who are left behind go through. And so we have to be balanced about this. You know, Christians sometimes say that if you're a true believer, I don't know if you've ever heard this one before, if you're a real believer, then death should not be sorrowful. There should be no grief in death. It should be joyful. It should be a celebration. But that's too easy. That's too pat. It doesn't take into consideration the actual experience of all of us as human beings. There is grief. There is sorrow. And I think there's supposed to be. And I think Jesus shows us that there's supposed to be as well. The immediate story that came to mind as I was thinking about this was Jesus and Lazarus. And if you want to read along at John 11, let's see how Jesus deals with the death of a loved one. What does he go through? After all, he's our model. We need to fly to him in all these difficult times of our lives to understand what does it look like for someone who was one with a father to deal with life as a human being. Now a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was the Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. So the sister sent word to him, saying, "Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick." But when Jesus heard this, he said, "This sickness is not to end in death, but for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified by it." Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that he was sick, he then stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Then after this, he said to the disciples, "Let us go to Judea again." And this kicks off a discussion because he just flew from Judea. They were trying to stone him there. And they say, "You're crazy. You're going back?" You know, but he's trying to point out to them, you know, this is something that he needs to do. His friend Lazarus is asleep and he's going to go wake him up. And they misunderstand, so he has to be more specific. He's died. But he's going with a purpose, with a specific purpose. Picking it up in verse 17. So when Jesus came, he found that he had already been in the tomb for 4 days, Lazarus had. Now Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. Martha, therefore, when she heard that Jesus was coming, went to meet him, but Mary stayed at the house. Martha then said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Even now, I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha said, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even if he dies, and everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this?" And she said to him, "Yes, Lord. I have believed that you are the Christ, the Son of God, even he who comes into the world." And when she had said this, she went away and called Mary, her sister, saying secretly, "The teacher is here and calling for you." And when she heard it, she got up quickly and was coming to him. Therefore, when Mary came where Jesus was, she saw him and fell at his feet and said to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus therefore saw her weeping and the Jews who came with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and was troubled and said, "Where have you laid him?" And they said to him, "Lord, come and see." And Jesus wept. That verse 35 is celebrated as the shortest verse in the Bible, but one of the ones that is most loaded. I'm stopping the story right where most commentators start it, right? They focus on the resurrection, the raising to life. They focus on the miracle. They focus on these things. But I want to just focus on two questions that are germane to us, relevant to us this morning. First, when Jesus heard that his friend was sick, why did he wait 2 more days before he set off to go be with him? And secondly, if he knew what he was going to do, if he knew that he was going to raise him to life, then why did he weep? What were the tears for, if he knew the outcome? Now, if you read commentaries on this, they have lots of different reasons, and they go back and forth and try to make sense of why all of these things are written as they are in John's Gospel. But what you come down to is that Jesus waited 2 days in order to give Lazarus time to die, so that he could raise him up, so that he could glorify God. And that's implied right in the text, that he did all this purposely in order for that to happen. But it seems kind of cruel, doesn't it? These are some of his best friends who are really suffering, and he's going to let them go through more suffering in order for something else to happen. And then if he knows what he's going to do and he comes and he weeps, most commentators are saying, well, what he's really doing is he is generalizing the grief and extending his grief to those who are going to see the miracle and still not believe, and therefore not be able to be joined to his Father in oneness? That he is moving out into that future arena. Just as he does when he weeps, the only other time that he's said to weep in the Gospels is over Jerusalem. When he realizes that they are not going to come and shelter under his wings, and they are going to have to go through what they go through when Jerusalem is destroyed. These are possible explanations. They're plausible explanations. For my money, they're a bit too complex, and they're a little bit too clever by half. And to me, to my mind, with everything that I have come to believe about Jesus, everything that I have come to believe about who he is in relationship to his Father, the oneness, the singleness that he has with his Father's love, that this is out of character for him. That he wouldn't do something hurtful, even in order to do something good. Because remember what we said when we talked about James. The quality of the means we use must match the quality of the ends that we seek. Or turned around the other way, the quality of the means that we use always match the quality of the ends that we produce. Do we really get away with being cruel to be kind? Do we get away with that? Is that what Jesus is about? I'd like to point you in another direction. I can't prove it, but everything in my spirit tells me it's true. Everything about Jesus was about kingdom. His whole ministry, if you want to boil it down to one thing, was to show everyone the Father. They had one opinion of the Father as king up on his lofty throne. Jesus calls him Abba, Daddy, and says he's also the daddy into whose lap you can crawl. You can have that intimate relationship with him. And it's called kingdom when you do. When you are in the here and now, in this moment, connected so deeply with the Father that time seems to stand still, that you don't even notice the things that you brought in your head. They've been displaced by the allness of this time. That is who your Father is. This kingdom moment, this way of living in the constant awareness of the Father, this laser-like presence that we can bring to the moment and to each other is everything that Jesus was about. And every time that you read a scene with him, you can see that presence, that connection. He sees everybody exactly where they are. And regardless of what they come to him for or ask him, he goes right to the source of what they need to know, what they need to feel, the next step that they need to take. That kind of presence is singular. It's all-encompassing. It's immersive. And Jesus practiced it all the time. Where he is when the word comes to him that Lazarus is sick is what the text here says, beyond Jordan, which means right along the banks of the Jordan. It's where John the Baptist was baptizing along the riverbanks. And he was working there. He had fled Judea. He goes there and he's working with people who live on the back of beyond, those who are out in the rural areas. And the text tells us many believed. They were coming to him. He was connecting with them. He was working with them. He was present to them. What Jesus is teaching us to do here is that the most important person in the world is the one who is right in front of you at this moment. Not the ones who are remote, not the ones who live in our heads. Even if they are our significant others in our family, if they're not here right now, the one who is the one that we are connected with, that we can be one with, that we will understand kingdom through. That person. Jesus was so present to them that he couldn't leave for 2 days because his work wasn't finished yet. He was doing what he was there to do. His whole mission and purpose was to connect heart to heart with the people with whom he came in contact with. And when he got to a point that he could leave, let's go. And when he gets to Bethany, he is just as present with Mary and Martha and the family and the friends as he was beyond Jordan. And he knew what he was going to do. He knew the power that existed with him and his Father. But he was so present to those people, connected to their grief, that he couldn't help but be drawn into it. The second beatitude says, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted." We talked about that in James 2 last week, where he talks about be mournful, be miserable. Remember how jarring that was to our ears? But what they're both talking about is the same thing that's happening here. Ebal in Aramaic, which we have translated as mourn, means to long deeply, to long with everything that's in you for some sort of change, for something that doesn't exist yet, to fill something that is void in the people or the environment around you. To long for that change, to long for that filling so deeply that you are weak and broken from the desire. That kind of mourning knows no bounds. That kind of mourning doesn't know where you end and the other begins. That kind of mourning connects us. And when that happens, it's not that we will be comforted later in reward for what we do now. The connection itself is the comfort, literally the face of, bayan net bayun in Aramaic, the face of that for which we long, is there in the connection. Jesus wept because the moment was the moment he was immersed in. The next moment contained the healing. This moment contained the grief. And what do you say to someone who's grieving? What do you do to make it all better? Anything that you try to say, anything that you try to intellectually walk them through, is only going to make a mess of things. It's only going to make it worse. There is nothing to tell someone who's in the midst of their grief. All you can do is cry with them. Let them know that you are connected with them. And this is what Jesus is doing. In that moment, with Martha, with Mary, one, crying as they cried, in the next moment, moving out to heal. This lesson cannot be lost on us. This is the lesson that we need to learn. Right now, you've heard me say this before, in this room, all of us together, this is the entire globe. This is the entire population of the earth. For us, right now, these faces that I'm looking at, that's it. We're either present to each other or we're nowhere, because there's nowhere else to be. This is it. Jesus is saying, be present. Connect with. Mourn with. It's the most comforting thing that can happen, is to simply lay your head on someone's shoulder and be with them and let them know that you're connected. Because that's the thing that has been torn from them in their moment of grief. What about this fear of death that we have? Jesus deals with the sorrow of death by entering into the moment. And what about the fear? Should we be fearing death? We can't help but fear the things we don't know and don't understand, can we? That's sort of a human trait. We don't know the mechanics of death. We don't know the mechanics of the afterlife. We don't know the things that are going to happen. We don't know the what's of this whole activity that we call death. And so we fear it, just like we fear anything else we don't know and don't understand. And the catch is that as long as we're here, living and breathing, we can't know about something that by definition is beyond our senses, beyond our mind's ability to grasp. So we can't come at this directly. We can't know what death is all about, and we can't dissipate our fear simply through clarity, simply through understanding and intellectual exercises. But there is a way that we can do this. We can come at it another way. Because as we said last week, James went on a journey with God. He went full circle and came back to where he started and understood and brought back with him an understanding of how this thing works, how this relationship works with God. And if we go on that journey with God, we will learn something about him. Not about death or the afterlife, but about our God. But when we know something about that reality, that ultimate reality that Jesus is showing us, and we understand who he is, that he is love and is forgiveness and is salvation and redemption and healing and all those things that we crave deep in our spirit, That every time we approach Him, we are approaching those qualities, those things. How can we lose? What is it that is left to be afraid of once we start to know who our Father is? One of my favorite books is The Prophet by Khalil Gibran. And he writes 26 essays on different topics here, coming out of the mouth of the prophet who is leaving a particular territory. And all the people come to see him off and they ask him questions about the basic things of life. And the last thing they ask him is about death. And I want to read you just a short passage here. Then Almitra spoke, saying, "We would ask now of death." And the prophet said, "You would know the secret of death, but how shall you find it unless you seek it in the heart of life? The owl whose night-bound eyes are blind unto the day cannot unveil the mystery of light. If you indeed behold the spirit of death, open your heart wide unto the body of life. For life and death are one, even as the river and sea are one. In the depths of your hopes and desires lies your silent knowledge of the beyond. And like seeds dreaming beneath the snow, your heart dreams of spring. Trust the dreams, for in them is hidden the gate to eternity. Your fear of death is but the trembling of the shepherd when he stands before the king whose hand is to be laid upon him in honor. Is the sheared not joyful beneath his trembling, that he shall wear the mark of the king? Yet is he not more mindful of his trembling? For what is it to die but stand naked in the wind and melt into the sun? And what is it to cease breathing but to free the breath from its restless tides that it may rise and expand and seek God unencumbered? Only when you drink from the river of silence shall you indeed sing. And when you have reached the mountaintop, then you shall begin to climb. And when the earth shall claim your limbs, then you shall truly dance." Khalil took a journey too, and he came to the place that Jesus led him. And he realized that the fear of death is really just the fear of life. We are too afraid to live life on its own terms, to really move into those moments and find out what is there. We hold ourselves back, we stay in reserve, we play it safe. And we never really understand who this God is that we are dealing with. And because we don't know that, we continue to fear. Without the moment in which we immerse ourselves into God's presence, we can't know the reality of God that Jesus was trying to get across to us. Often I hear people say, when we stand before that great white throne, when we stand before God, it's like your life is going to play on like a movie out in front of everybody, and you're going to feel the shame of your sins and the life that you led, and you'll feel the regret of the things that you left undone. Have you heard that one before? Does that make any sense to any of you? When you are standing in the presence of love itself, redemption itself, forgiveness, healing, how in the world are you going to feel anything but love, forgiveness, healing, redemption, salvation? It is not possible to stand in the presence of those things itself and feel anything but those things, to know that you are so fully accepted, that there was nothing you could ever do to lose it in the first place as long as you don't go stand in the shade. God's sun is shining full blast in all directions, and all we have to do is come stand in the rays, and they are ours. He promised us. Once we know that, what is there to be afraid of? Only when you drink from the river of silence shall you indeed sing. And when you have reached the mountaintop, then you shall begin to climb. And when the earth shall claim your limbs, then you shall truly dance. Jesus said, when you lose your life, that's when you find it. It's the truth. It's what each of us as humans will come to understand when we take the journey, when we immerse ourselves into that life. That unity that awaits us across death is an extension of the unity that we can have and feel right here and right now. It just moves into that new dimension. When the quality of the ends we use matches the quality of the ends we seek, we are moving, we are learning something about the nature of our God. Jesus leaves us more breadcrumbs along the way. Do you remember the silly scene with the Sadducees who did not believe in a resurrection and came to him and gave him this hyperbolic situation? Okay, there's a woman. Her husband dies. He had six brothers. So she, under Jewish law, had to marry each one of the six brothers, and they all died. Talk about a black widow. All seven of her husbands die. And so they say, in the next life, Jesus, chuckle, chuckle, wink, wink, whose husband, whose wife is she going to be? Which one will be her husband? As if to trip him up and show the absurdity of his position of a belief in a next life. But Jesus is equal to the task, of course. He says, you don't understand. No one is given in marriage in the next life. They're like the angels in heaven. And I want you to think about that for a second. And I know for some of you, you've heard this before. But this one clue just blows my mind. Imagine an existence without a best friend. Imagine an existence without a significant other. Without ever being able to pair off. Without ever getting married. Without ever having one person whose head shares your pillow that you confide in. Without inner rings. Can you even conceive of a life like that? It sounds alien. It sounds subhuman. It just sounds weird, and I don't even want to deal with it. But the truth that Jesus is bringing to us is that the unity in this life will be so complete that everyone is our best friend. We have an infinite number of best friends. We have an infinite number of spouses. Now, that's a tough one, huh? We will not miss for an instant the lack of our inner circle, because everyone we are with is our inner circle. Everyone we are with at that moment is the most important person, as he or she should be right now. If we can start to practice that now, the shock will be much less when we get to the next side. This is what he's trying to point out to us. Practice unity now. Move into your moments now. Live your life now that there are no regrets. Live your life now in such a way that you understand the unity of this Father that is so complete that it's all good news, no bad news, and the fear begins to dissipate. I wanted to read one more passage to you that I read at memorial services a lot, because it just says what needs to be said. And it comes from another tradition. It's from the great Shawnee chief, Tecumseh, 18th century chief. And he writes, "So live your life that the fear of death can never enter your heart. Love your life. Perfect your life. Beautify all things in your life. Seek to make your life long and of service to your people. Show respect to all people, but grovel to none. When you arise in the morning, give thanks for the light, for your life, for your strength. Give thanks for your food and for the joy of living. If you see no reason for giving thanks, the fault lies only in yourself. When it comes your time to die, be not like those whose hearts are filled with the fear of death, so that when their time comes, they weep and pray for a little more time to live their lives over again in a different way. Sing your death song. And die like a hero going home." If we lived our lives that way, what place does fear have in anything that we do? This is our elegy. An elegy is a poem or a song in lament, especially for the dead. This is our elegy, the elegy that Jesus gives us, our ability to move through life with all of its grief. To be able to weep fully when the grief is in our moment. To not be ashamed, to not hold back, to enter completely into the grief. And know that the unity that that grief represents, the connection with the other person, allows us those tears. But that same unity, that same connection, is what is also connecting us to the source of all healing, of all love, forgiveness, and salvation. And in that moment, we will dance. One thing, unity, connection, leads us through our lives in all of the different ways and all of the complex mix of emotions that we will feel and all of the difficult things that we will face. One thing, our Father in heaven guiding us so that we can be fully human and fully present to everyone that we meet. Let's pray. Father, just want to remember Liz. Want to celebrate her life with us. We want to thank you for the time that we had with her. And as she is experiencing whatever she's experiencing with you, we ask that you would help us to practice more and more of that kind of connection and presence in each moment of our lives so that we can face whatever we need to face and still reflect you, reflect your love, reflect your presence. And when our time comes, as unexpected as it may be, when we finally realize, oh my God, this is my moment, this is the moment of my death, that we can give that impish smile and we can run to open that gift that you have given us. That's how we want to live, Father. Full of joyful expectation, but never afraid to shed our tears and to feel every rich human emotion that you have made available to us. We love you because you first loved us, Lord. Thank you for holding us in the palm of your hand. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand.